The financial views and information provided by Master Your Finances and its guests are intended for general informational purposes only. The material discussed is not designed to provide listeners with individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. Always consult your financial planner for professional advice.
Planning your financial future doesn't have to be overwhelming. 107.7 The Bronx presents Master Your Finances with Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional with certified wealth management and investment. Over the next hour, Kurt and his expert team of financial guests will help to decipher financial terms, navigate market trends, interpret federal and state regulations, and more, so you can make smart decisions with your money to increase your personal wealth. Phone lines are open. If you have a question about personal or small business financial planning, call Kurt Baker now at 877-900-1077. Master Your Finances is underwritten by Certified Wealth Management and Investment, focusing on personal, financial, and small business planning. For more information about all of Certified Wealth Management and Investment Services, online it's cwmi.us.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx, 107.7thebronx.com, live from Killarney Public House Studios. You're listening to Master Your Finances. It's presented by Certified Wealth Management and Investment. I am Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional. I'll be hosting your show today. I'm located here in Princeton, New Jersey. I can be reached through our website, which is www.cwmi.us, or directly at 609-716-4700. And today is our producer, Haley, and I just want to make a congratulatory announcement to the Bronx in general. The Princeton Review has just announced that they have been ranked number 15 in the country as far as radio stations going, and that's the number one. That would be the number one college radio station here in the in the New Jersey and Pennsylvania area. So congratulations to the Bronx and everybody who runs the station, including Haley. Last week we had on Suzanne Nielsen, owner of The Organized Life, and she can help you get organized. If you missed that show, you can go to the www.masteryourfinances.us and you can listen to the podcast there. This week we're very pleased to have with us Patrick L. Ryan, the president and CEO of First Bank, who has a long and distinguished career, even though he's very young. He is the president CEO of the First Bank and also on the board of directors. He has been involved in the recapitalization of First Bank as well as bringing it public, I guess, to NASDAQ, the symbol being FRBA. And he's also done some additional financing, subordinate financing. So he's been very involved in turning First Bank and expanding it and growing it. He's got many distinguished awards and so forth. Prior to this, he worked for Goldman Sachs. He was involved in the merger and acquisition, including Nations Bank and Bank of America. And he's done quite a bit. He's got an MBA as well from Dartmouth University. And he graduated summa cum laude. He's also graduated top 20% of his MBA class. He's very heavily involved in the community operations, as well as the Hamilton Partnership, Mercer County 200 Club, Robert Wood Johnson Hamilton Foundation, Friendly Sons and Daughters of St. Patrick, Community Bankers Association, New Jersey Bankers Association, Board of Directors of YMCA, coaches his kids Little League, as well as ice hockey. Some of his professional awards have been New Jersey Bankers Association News Leaders in Banking in 2011, as well as New Jersey Biz 40 Under 40 recipient in 2014. And just recently, the distinguished Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital Young Professional of the Year. That's for this year, 2015. He lives in Pennington, New Jersey. He's married to Ashley Ryan, and they are proud parents of three children, nine-year-old fraternal twins Liam, who happens to be with us, Ryan, Lily, and two-year-old Quinn. And Pat's interests include hiking and his family, be with his family, ice hockey, golf, kayaking, American history, and political philosophy. I'm not sure how you do all this, Pat, quite frankly, but
yeah, well, they're interests. That doesn't mean I get to spend a lot of time on them.
So you've been very, very kind to come in today, and we're going to talk a little bit about your history, how you got involved in banking, community banking. What is community banking? Some people don't really understand. We say that term a lot, but they don't really understand what it is, and how that's different from some of the larger banks like Bank of America and PNC, and what's been going on in the banking industry since the financial crisis, and how some of the regulations have affected banks such as First Bank, Community Bank, and where is banking going and the future of banking. So how did you get into banking? Why do you do this?
Well, it's a great question, Kurt. I mean, for me professionally, I've spent a lot of time doing some really interesting things. a lot of it really was spent trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I, quote unquote, grew up. And in the back of my mind, I guess it took me a while to figure it out. Banking had always been of interest to me, partly because my father, also Patrick Ryan, is a career banker. He ran Yardville National Bank here in the greater central New Jersey, Mercer County area for many years. And I'd actually spent a little bit of time working for him prior to business school and even doing some consulting projects on the side. But really, for me, it was about building my skill set. So when I came out of college, it was a liberal arts education, which was wonderful. But as many of us know, that doesn't really train you for anything specifically in the work world. And so, you know, I wanted to start building my my business skill set. Got an opportunity on Wall Street with Goldman Sachs, which was a great couple years, both in New York and a little bit of time over in London doing merger and acquisition work, as well as general corporate finance. And really learned a ton, but the lifestyle there is pretty challenging. And so I figured if I was going to commit to that, I wanted to see what else is out there, having really only had that one experience. And so I did get an opportunity back in the late 90s when the internet was first taking off, and worked with some folks out of New York who were building an internet healthcare company, saw the good, the bad, and the ugly of the first round of the internet boom in terms of a lot of exciting projects when that company was trying to get ready to go public. And then obviously when the market came down, spent a lot of time trying to figure out how they could stop spending so much money. So that's not always the funnest part of work, but it really learned a lot there. Was thankful that I got the opportunity to go to business school to really refine my my business and professional skill set. Spent 2 years up in New Hampshire learning a ton up at the Tuck School. From there, was still really candidly trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And one of the areas where I thought it might help build my professional skill set was in management consulting. And I, again, was lucky enough to land a job with a good firm up in Boston called Bain Consulting. Spent about a year and a half with them doing a combination of private equity consulting projects as well as some growth strategy projects. But one of the things I learned along the way was I really was, my mindset was an entrepreneurial mindset. I felt like I was an entrepreneur at heart. But I was missing one of the key ingredients for most entrepreneurs, which is a great new business idea. So in some ways, I felt like I was the worst kind of entrepreneur because that's what I wanted to do, but I didn't have any great ideas. And at the same time, there were some interesting things happening with my dad at Yardville Bank. They happened to get a activist hostile shareholder involved, and what occurred to me was there really were some unique opportunities in the community banking space. And absent a better idea, I became attracted to the idea of trying to help build and grow a company in community banking for a variety of reasons. So I went to work for him for a couple years prior to his bank ultimately being sold to PNC Bank. But in the back of my mind, I knew that if that didn't work, there may be an opportunity to get something new started, which is ultimately the genesis of First Bank. So shortly after Yardville was sold, teamed up with some folks, and we started on the path of the new venture, which is First Bank today.
Wow, that's quite a career path there. So I'm going to try to follow this a little bit. So you essentially, really, you were in the beginning, you just knew you liked finance. You knew you were in liberal arts, but you kind of got drawn into the financial world, it sounds like, somehow into the Goldman Sachs. And then it sounds like you had an interest there. And then you moved into like a healthcare area, but you still had this financial background. So you kind of looked at it from maybe a slightly different lens than some of the other people did, it sounds like.
Yeah, there was a specific event that sort of led to my shift. So I was a government major at Hamilton, and I did a semester down in Washington, D.C., thinking that might be where I wanted to go after school. And quite honestly, that semester opened my eyes to a lot of the things that a lot of people don't like about politics down in Washington. Okay. And it seemed to me that ultimately, if there was going to be an opportunity in politics, it would be later in life after I had had the opportunity to achieve some success in other realms. Because quite honestly, the jobs down in D.C. for people coming out of school were, you know, they were investment banking hours without investment banking pay, which didn't seem like a great trade to me. So,
okay. Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, Pat, you ran us through a very interesting career path, which really is gaining a lot of experience. And you've touched on a lot of different areas, including government, banking, healthcare, investment banking and so forth. So you built all this up. Plus your family, your father is a career banker and has been heavily involved in Yardville National Bank and the sale of it. So now you've got a lot of experience, you've got a lot of enthusiasm, and you've got a lot of the knowledge and networking. So now we're going to start working on First Bank. We're going to talk about that and more when we come back in just a few minutes.
The financial views and information provided by Master Your Finances and its guests are intended for general informational purposes only. The material discussed is not designed to provide listeners with individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. Always consult your financial planner for professional advice.
We're talking finances so you can make informed choices for a brighter financial future. Now back to Master Your Finances with Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional with certified wealth management and investment on 1077 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Master Your Finances. I'm Kurt Baker, certified financial planner, a professional here with Pat Ryan, president and CEO of First Bank. And Pat's kind of walk us through his goals and objectives when he was very young were to be entrepreneurial. And he kind of walked us through developing some of the skill set that he thought he would need later in life in order to do that. So he went into finance, he went into consulting, he went into business administrative areas, and really to kind of build up his experience and expertise in these different areas with the idea that eventually he really wanted to go out and create and be more entrepreneurial. And he ended up following in his father's footsteps, who had been in banking his entire career, pretty much a long career in that. And so now we're to the point where First Bank comes into your life, right? So so how did you get involved in the, I know your father was in banking, so how did that kind of transition where you're now the president, CEO, board member, and you were very instrumental in the financing and structuring of the First Bank. So how did all that kind of happen?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story, really, Kurt, because it was sort of your typical startup venture, but it was being done at a time that was in an industry that was severely impacted by the financial crisis. And so ultimately what happened as Yardville agreed to be sold to PNC, I was quickly thinking about what would be next for me. I knew, based on my previous experience, that going to work at a large banking organization probably wouldn't be a great fit. And so it was really a quick transition in my mind to figure out, hey, can we get a new bank started? We thought there'd be a good opportunity with Yardville having been sold to a larger banking organization and several other banks in the area that had recently been acquired. We thought that there would be a nice opening within the community banking space to try to get something new started. And it was really from there a function of putting the right team together, trying to go out and find investors. Certainly our industry is heavily regulated, so there was a regulatory component to it. In fact, early on, what we hoped we'd do was get some investors, go out and get a new charter and start the bank. And because of what was going on out in the financial markets, the regulators basically stopped issuing any new charters. So it's not something that's talked about a lot, but if you look back over the last 7 years, I think there's been two new charters approved in a seven-year period when, if you looked back prior to the crisis, I think they were issuing anywhere from 20 to 40 new charters a year. So clearly, getting something brand new started was going to be more difficult. But ultimately, what the regulators were doing were they were trying to get folks like us to team up with some banks that were out there that needed capital, that needed some assistance, and really try to induce us to make an acquisition of sorts, which is what we did. So we ended up doing what's called a change in control recapitalization to get our venture off the ground. And so ultimately our pool of capital, which turned out to be just under $20 million, was invested into the existing business, which was called First Bank of Williamstown. They were located.
So let me make sure I understand. Now, First Bank was an existing bank. Is that correct? Is that my
exactly.
understanding?
Exactly.
So you came in and so you had your investors. You were kind of ready to go. You're thinking, let's start up a new charter. Let's go ahead your original thought was, we're going to start a brand new bank. But then when you found out the regulatory atmosphere was really, hey, we're not going to issue new charters. That's not where we're at. We really want to try to get the banks that are out there healthier. Was that their goal?
Let's
see
right.
if you're interested
right.
in a bank, instead of creating a new one, hey, we'd rather you come out and maybe you can turn this bank around and make it better than what it is in some way, shape, or form, right? So that's the regulatory. Now, is that still the way things are continuing today, as far as you know? Because I've heard that the community banking is really kind of tough to get into right now.
Yeah, no, it's still the same. So there was a bank in central Pennsylvania, Bank of Bird and Hand, that got approved a couple years ago, and then they just approved moved a bank up in New Hampshire. So that was the second new charter that the regulators had issued in, like I said, I think the last 6 or 7 years. So that's still pretty much the way it's working. So there have been other folks who have gotten into banking similar to what we did through these recapitalization plans. But that's really been the only vehicle of the last few years if you wanted to get something new started. So
okay. So it sounds like it's been pretty successful, though. So
it was an interesting ride those first few years, no doubt about it. I mean, we finalized our recapitalization in late October of 2008. I don't remember exactly. I think it might have been shortly after Lehman Brothers went down.
This is 2008, right?
Yeah, 2008.
I think I remember that.
Yeah. So there were a lot of bad things happening, and we were fortunate that we had been able to get a good group of investors. So the majority of the folks who had committed prior to the depth of the crisis stayed with us. And like I said, we did raise a significant amount of capital to do the recap. And, from there, it was really it was almost a battle on three fronts. So we're trying to get a new bank started, which means finding new customers, trying to get up to profitability. And in any environment, that's a challenge. And then on top of that, we had some cleanup work to do with the bank that we had done the recap with. They had gotten into some trouble with some loans that we had to work our way out of. So we had kind of a second battle going with the cleanup effort. And then the third battle was just the regulatory environment. So in 2009, it was a little bit of a shoot first, ask questions later environment. And to some degree, I understand that, right? The regulators were taking a lot of heat from Congress because they wanted to know why the regulators had let these bad things happen. And the problem became a lot of the issues that were driving the crisis weren't really community banking issues, but the regulators didn't have boots on the ground, if you will, in a lot of these non-bank entities that had helped drive some of the problems. And so if they were going to show that they were taking the problem serious, the only way they could do that was where they already had people in position to start pushing change. And so I think the community banks, unfortunately, felt a big brunt of that change in regulatory philosophy.
I'm sure you may agree with this, is that the community banks seem to take the brunt of the punishment when it was the bigger banks and the other entities that were really creating most of the issues. At least the community banks I had dealt with, most of them were kind of doing things on a very prudent underwriting standpoint. Maybe First Bank had some issues, but as a group, it seemed like they were more in line with prudent banking than some of the larger banks who kind of got a little bit out of control.
No, that's exactly right. And quite honestly, I think it had to do with a mismatch in terms of where the resources were and where the problems were. So a lot of business moved outside of the banking sector in the 20 years prior to the financial crisis. And so a lot of the financial business that was getting done in non-regulated entities. And so now there's a problem. The regulators need to show that they're acting, but they only have people in place at organizations that, even if they weren't causing the problem, they had to show that they were taking things seriously. So what you've seen, I think, is a greater awareness more recently on the regulatory side that, hey, it's not just banks that we need to be worried about. There's lots of other financial institutions that were not traditionally regulated that we need to keep our eye on. But for those first few years, I do believe that the banks took the brunt of it. And I don't think community banks alone, certainly the larger institutions, were getting regulated as well. Don't get me wrong. They just happen to have a little more strength in lobbying areas and other things where I think they were able to push back probably a little better than some of the small banks where we really didn't have much to push back on. So
yeah, I think that's true. I mean, when you're a large entity, that is one of the advantages. You can sit somebody down in Washington full time if you need to and have them talking to the regulators all the time. So you mentioned that when you first got into it, you really had three areas that became a challenge basically you're kind of turning the bank around a little bit, right? You need to really get your customers. You got to make it profitable. At the time, we're talking 2008, 2009, when the whole lending industry was really struggling. So you had a lot of some loans, a little bit of a hangover from the other people that were running the bank as far as the way their lending practices were, just the general environment. And then the regulatory environment was really tightening up very much so, and they were really focused on the regulatory end of it. So they were kind of coming down on you when you really weren't involved in the issues that you were trying to resolve.
You were
kind of on their side in some ways, but they were coming after you.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was a real eye-opener when the examiners came in to do their exam in, I think it was March or April of 2009, and we were very mistakenly thinking of ourselves as people that had come in. We brought a lot of capital, we brought a lot of experience, we brought a great new set of directors, and we really viewed ourselves as people that were going to help resolve this issue. But the regulatory mindset was very different, right? At the end of the day, they didn't care that we were an entirely new team with a whole bunch of new capital and a new plan. It was, these are problems, we want them resolved, and so we had a lot of work to do, and over the next 12 to 18 months, we worked very, very hard. But we had a great team, and quite honestly, in that period, we had gotten ourselves to a significantly better point where we were now profitable, the regulators were happy with what we were doing, and we'd gotten through a lot of the cleanup issues. So by the time we got to, you know, mid-2010, we were really in a position where we could focus on growth and expansion, and that's really what we've been doing for the last few years. So
that's great. So thank you, Pat. You kind of walked us through what it was like to kind of recapitalize the bank and bring in new customers and make it profitable, kind of clean up the issues of the previous administration, so to speak, and people that were running it, and then how you're dealing, kind of being thrown into the fire as far as the regulatory process goes. And we'll talk about that and more when we come back, as far as how, like, the Dodd-Frank and some of the issues that have changed since 08, 09 to date, and how that's affected banking and maybe how that's going to move us forward. We'll be right back.
The financial views and information provided by Master Your Finances and its guests are intended for general informational purposes only. The material discussed is not designed to provide listeners with individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. Always consult your financial planner for professional advice.
We're talking finances so you can make informed choices for a brighter financial future. Now back to Master Your Finances with Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional with certified wealth management and investment on 1077 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Master Your Finances. I'm Kurt Baker. I'm here with Pat Ryan, President and CEO of First Bank, and he's kind of walked us through his career, building up his career as an entrepreneur by getting experience in financing, consulting, and business, building up his resume so he had some experience to go out and essentially recapitalize and reinvigorate First Bank, brought in about $20 million and a whole new team, and they went through the process of turning the bank into profitability, dealing with the cleanup of the previous administration and their loan issues, and then dealing with the regulatory environment. It was a very difficult process in the 08-09 range, and how that's changed throughout the time. And now we're growing. We're like in about, I think we're in about 2010 or so, right? So now you're showing profitability. You're showing the regulators that you're starting to really turn this around. And so now you're dealing kind of this post Dodd-Frank implementation process that we're in. So we got your community banks, and then you've got your large banks. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that dealing with a large bank is not the same as dealing with a community bank. What are some of those differences and pros and cons of dealing with each type of institution?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Kurt, because there really is no true technical definition of a community bank. I think for a lot of people it means something different, but ultimately what in my mind it means is it's a way of doing business, right? It's being local, it's being in the community, it's knowing your customers. And quite honestly, I think the biggest thing is it's finding a way to get things done. And one of the things that's happened in the banking space, as there's been a lot of consolidation, as we've created these trillion-dollar behemoths, is they really don't have a lot of room for flexibility, right? If you walk into those branches, they have their policies, they have their procedures, and that's the way it's got to be. And I can understand that to some degree, because when you're that big and you're that bureaucratic, you've got to have those controls in place or else you're going to have big problems. But when you're smaller and you know your customer and you know your staff, there are ways to get things done to try to minimize some of the unpleasantness that goes along with banking, unfortunately. And so the community bank mindset is really about service. It's about finding a way to get things done, and it's about knowing your customer. And quite honestly, those are things that can really only happen when you're a certain size. So said another way, you get big enough, all of a sudden you lose some of that flexibility and some of that local knowledge that is the essence really of what a community bank's all about. So
no, I agree with that. And I think some people have kind of forgotten. I hear people complain a lot about banking. I mean, it seems to be it's the industry you love to hate, so to speak. I mean, yeah. We deal with it. And what's interesting to me is sometimes people be dealing with a bank, they really don't like dealing with a bank, but they don't think that they actually have other options. And and I think that's a mistake, because there are different ways of doing banking. And if you're really not happy with the fact that you're getting an impersonal situation and they're not really responding to your needs, there are other options there. It's not all cookie cutter banking. I think some people think that if you're getting a loan or getting a service from one bank is exactly the same as getting from another, and it's really just not.
That's exactly right, and I think it comes down to the customer and what their primary needs are. So if you're a customer that travels a lot and you want access to cash from thousands of ATMs around the country or around the world, and having a local relationship with your banker doesn't really mean much to you, then candidly, in a lot of cases like that, you're going to be better off with the larger institution, despite some of the headaches that go along with dealing with the bigger banks. But I think there's a lot of people that really care most about service. They care most about having that relationship. And you're right, I think some of those folks were probably part of banks like that in the past. Their bank was probably acquired. They didn't want to deal with the hassle of making a change until they ultimately needed something, which may be 2, 3, 10 years down the road. And now all of a sudden, there's no relationship and life's very difficult. And I think the important thing for those folks to understand is there are options out there. And unfortunately for us in the community banking industry, we don't have the marketing budgets that the big guys have. And so you're probably not going to see a community bank ad in the Super Bowl this year. But there are a lot of things we're doing out in the community to get the word out. And for folks that care about that relationship and care about that higher level of service, it is worth the effort to try to find a good local community bank, because I think you're exactly right. They will see a big difference in how they're treated
and
there.
I think one area that specifically, at least the clients that I deal with, I think when they're small business owners especially, I think that's where I see a noticeable difference in the service level, because they get to understand the business, and they at least that's the experience I've seen. And community banks tend to try to fit the product and the profile to kind of match up as far as what they may need from a capital standpoint and things like that. And they tend to really kind of tailor it to your business. They tend to understand the cycles of your business and things like that a little bit better than maybe a large bank that's kind of cookie cuttering and dealing with a certain set of guidelines, and they really have to fit you in those guidelines, whether it makes sense for you or not.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the way I think about it, Kurt, is it's the difference between selling products and providing solutions. So larger institutions, again, I think because of the bureaucracy and their size, they have products. So they have a way they do business. We refer to it as being in the box, right? So if you're a small business that fits in the box of a large institution, that may work okay. Unfortunately, the boxes tend to be relatively small, and they don't provide a lot of room for flexibility. Whereas when we're out talking to folks from a community banking standpoint, I'm not trying to sell anything, right? I want to understand what your needs are, how much money do you need, what do you need it for, how do you want to pay it back, what are the trends in your business, and then coming up with a financing solution or financing package that meets those needs. And so it's just a very different conversation when you're talking with a community bank. And I think it's a conversation that most folks prefer to have, right? Because they don't want to try to figure out how their needs can be modified to fit into a product context. They want what they want. And it's up to us as bankers to spend the time to figure out what those needs are and find the solution. And I think as an industry, the community banks are really good at doing that.
And I think one thing you point out that I want to really emphasize is the solution. One thing I've noticed is that community bankers tend to come in. They don't just provide the financing. You don't come in and say, I want a loan for whatever, $100,000 to do XYZ. You're coming in and having a conversation saying, how do we grow your business so you can afford to pay this? It's not just about the loan. I've noticed the community banks tend to have expertise locally saying, oh, if you're going to open up a business locally, they'll have information about if you have a plan, a business plan, they can actually help provide feedback on whether that plan may actually work, because they'll kind of know the local business atmosphere and maybe whether or not you need a deli or whether you need a new whatever the case may be, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think part of it comes back to the local knowledge, right? So if you're a new business trying to get off the ground in a market and you're dealing with a banker who knows that market well and who knows what the key trends are, I think there's a lot of expertise that the bankers and the community bank level can bring to bear. And and some of it, quite honestly, just has to do with the level of person you're dealing with, right? So if you're a small business borrower who wants to borrow a couple $100,000 and you go into one of the large international money center banks, candidly, you're probably going to be dealing with a lower level person. Whereas, you know, we've got a great lending team, and I'm meeting a lot of folks myself, our chief lending officer, our team leader. So you're probably going to be dealing with somebody at the community bank level who's got more experience, who's at a higher level, candidly, who probably is a decision maker versus someone who's just collecting information to pass it along to get processed out of market. So I think there is a lot of intangible value that folks can get by dealing locally with a community bank in terms of the level of the person they're dealing with, knowing that they're talking to someone who's involved in the decision-making process, and knowing that they're talking to someone who knows the market and can be helpful. I think those are things that make a big difference. Now, we're still in a heavily regulated industry, and there's unfortunately more bureaucracy, even dealing with a community bank, than we would like to have. And I tell people up front, I say, listen, there's a lot of information we're going to need to figure out what is the right credit facility to make sense here. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff we're going to ask you for, because if we don't have it in the file, we're going to get criticized for not having it in the file. And I tell them up front, and I apologize up front, but you know, that's the world we live in today, that you know, you just need more and more information, and you try to explain that to folks. But the benefit, again, of working with the community bank is once you've gone through that process, you've shared all that information, now the file's been built, the relationship's built, the knowledge base is built, that next loan is much easier. And that's what relationship banking is really all about.
Oh, I think I agree with that. And I think you bring up a major point that you touched on briefly, is that the larger banks tend to have a sweet spot on what they want to lend. Their minimum loan that they really want might be $1 million. And if you're looking for $200,000, yeah, they might do it, but that's not really their target business. So they're going to kind of put you down to somebody who's relatively new in the business, may not understand how to provide a solution, or even know which box to put you in when they're trying to sell product, whereas you're actually trying to provide a solution, and your sweet spot might be a little different, and you might actually fit right into the profile of what that business actually needs. And this may be an area that you're very interested in lending to, and you'll have expertise in there, and you'll have information on the ground as far as what they might need and how to help them provide the solution.
Yeah, and I think you hit on two interesting points there, Kurt. The first point is the bigger banks tend to focus on larger deals. And you mentioned $1 million. Actually, I think most of the largest national and international banks are looking to lend $10, $20, $50 million a pop, not $1 million. But that is an issue in terms of the size, right? A $1 million deal for us is a meaningful piece of business. $1 million for a bank that has a $1 trillion balance sheet, it sort of doesn't matter.
So it's like the large bank is looking to lend the amount of money you recapitalize your entire bank for.
Oh yeah, or more.
So that's interesting. Honestly, yeah. So if you kind of put that all in perspective, you really kind of sympathize and can empathize with your small business owner, because you're really one of them as well.
That's right. That's
you're in the same boat they are, so to speak. You're kind of dealing with your peers, so to speak, as business owners, which is really kind of nice.
Yeah.
And so Pat, I appreciate that very much. And you walked us through how you got your entrepreneurial experience, and now you're putting it into action nowadays. We'll finish that up, and we'll talk a little bit more about, now, where is banking headed? Where are we going to go in the future when we come back in just a few minutes?
The financial views and information provided by Master Your Finances and its guests are intended for general informational purposes only. The material discussed is not designed to provide listeners with individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. Always consult your financial planner for professional advice.
We're talking finances so you can make informed choices for a brighter financial future. Now back to Master Your Finances with Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional with Certified Wealth Management and Investment, on 1077 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Master Your Finances. I am Kurt Baker, here with Pat Ryan, the president and CEO of First Bank. And he went through how he built up his life experience to prep him for what ended up being the recapitalization and the running of First Bank. And then some of the experiences he dealt with initially, which were some of the challenges were of a new bank, is you had to bring it into profitability because he was recapitalizing and turning it around. You had to clean up some loan issues that were from the previous period of time, as well as the regulatory environment. environment was very difficult. And in banking, like a lot of industries, you have to deal with the regulation side, which is a very important aspect to make sure you take care of. And then we were talking about the difference between a community-type bank, a large bank, where it tends to be less flexible, tends not to know the customer as well. However, they do have a lot of ATMs if that's something you really need. And they really think of things as a commoditized selling products in the box type things. Whereas the smaller banks tend to be more flexible. They get to know the customer. They may go through the same regulatory issues initially, but once they kind of get through that and they really get to understand what you're about and what your business is about, they help you and they tend to be have expertise in the local market and can actually help you with your business model itself and help you to be profitable. And they also, they're not really in the box type things. They're really solution oriented rather than product oriented. And they tend to be, as we're talking to the banks, there's one other thing that they really tend to do a little bit differently than the big banks.
Yeah, well, just getting back on in terms of some of the differences, one of the other big things is the community banks really tend to be focused on two main lines of business, the deposit generation business and the lending business. And the reason that matters is because the larger organizations, they'll be in 10, 15, 20 different lines of business. And what that means is, depending on the time of day or the day of the week, they may be in or out of those businesses, depending on how they want to manage the overall organization. And, you know, for us, we're in our two businesses, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. That's not going to change. And I think that's important for folks to understand, especially on the borrowing side, because a lot of borrowers have gotten burned when larger institutions have decided, hey, we don't want to offer that product anymore, or we don't want to be in the lending business anymore. And I think folks can take a lot of comfort that when they're dealing with a community bank, we will be in the lending business because that is one of our only businesses. And I think that makes a big difference. It really becomes much more of a partnership as opposed to a situation where we're trying to just sell products. So,
no, I think that's important. I know some people got really burned when some of the large institutions completely got out of things like the mortgage business. There was really nobody else. There was really nobody to talk to at that point, whereas you're not going to do that. So where's banking heading now? Now that we've kind of got through most of this Dodd-Frank thing, I know it's been enacted and things, but so where are we headed from here? I mean, we have a whole new regulatory environment. Obviously, we still want to do banking business. So what do you see the future coming?
Well, I think what we're going to see is a continuation and perhaps an acceleration of the trends that have been going on in banking for the last 20, 30 years. And those are continued consolidation. It has gotten to the point where the profit margins in banking are tough, and sometimes it requires a little more size and scale to be able to generate the types of returns that investors need to invest in the banking industry. So if you look at the number of banks, I don't know, there were 15,000 banks 20 years ago. I think now there's 7,000 banks. And, you know, fast forward 5-10 years, I think you'll be looking at, a number in the low thousands in terms of the number of banks. So
the low thousands. That's a big move.
Yeah. Well, you think about it. If it was 15,000 down to 7, that's 8,000 banks that went away in 20 years. I think you're going to continue to see, banks going away as the consolidation trends continue. And at the same time, if the regulators are being more difficult letting new charters get off the ground, then I think that overall number of banks will continue to shrink. The other trend that I think you will continue to see is the smallest banks will be getting bigger, and not bigger to the sense that they're going to become like the regional or the national banks, but historically you could be a $100 million in asset or $200 million in asset community bank, service your community, generate a decent return, and you had a nice little business. And the reality now with the requirements from a regulatory standpoint, from a compliance standpoint, from a risk management standpoint, they're just greater requirements, which means more staff, more consultants, more expense, which means in order to generate a reasonable return, you're going to have to be bigger, and you're going to have to try to leverage some economies of scale. And so what I think you'll continue to see is a vibrant community banking business, but I think those community banks will be billion-dollar community banks in the future, not $100 million community
banks. So they're going to have to be 5 to 10 times what they are now, it sounds like, just to handle the regulatory overhead that's going on, it sounds like to me.
Yeah, I'd
that's
say
interesting.
At least or more. Or
wow.
More, yeah.
That's a big increase. I mean, that's saying that to me. That's saying something. If you have to increase your size 5 to 10 times or more to really just kind of handle the infrastructure of the compliance end of this and the consulting and other things that go into that, That's major. That means this Dodd-Frank thing has really added some initial cost. Is it just the Dodd-Frank, or is there other things going on?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to clarify. Dodd-Frank, obviously, is the biggest name in banking regulation. The technical reality of Dodd-Frank is a lot of the provisions aren't meant to apply to banks under $10 billion, but the reality of regulation is it all depends on the folks that are in there doing the exam, telling you what they think you need. And the things that we're hearing in the industry are the examiners are now asking small banks to have tools and staff and other things that they didn't need to have 10 and 15 years ago. And so that added expense, while not technically required because a bank isn't technically under Dodd-Frank, if an examiner comes in and says, hey, you need to do XYZ, you can't say, well, we're not under Dodd-Frank, so we're not going to do it. You're not going to be around too long with that.
Hard to argue with the regulators when they're making they kind of make a suggestion. We're like, yeah.
That's exactly right.
Right, so. I get you. Okay. So you want to keep them on the right. So hopefully, so it sounds like the consolidation of the industry is going to continue. It sounds like it's not likely they're going to open up, these new banks. It sounds like that's going to be pretty much the trend. It's still going to be difficult from what you can see to start a brand new bank.
I would think so. I mean, I think they will slowly allow a few more charters to get out there. But, the reality is there's going to be fewer people wanting to start new banks, because back when you could start a bank with $10 or $15 million and you knew you only had to get to $200 million to be a profitable, successful franchise, that felt like a reasonable goal. Well, if now, you probably need $30 or $40 million to get off the ground. That's a lot harder to track down in terms of new capital. And then you're saying to yourself, I've got to get to $1 billion.
That's a big jump.
That's a big jump, and that takes a long time. Now, when we were getting started, thankfully, a lot of us had been involved with, community banks that were a couple billion in size. And so we sort of had the roadmap. We knew where we were going and we knew how to get there. But a lot of folks that were starting community banks in the past, they weren't planning to get to $1 billion or $2 billion in size. They wanted to get to a couple hundred million. And so I think you'll see fewer of those new charters, either because they're not getting approved or because people realize the amount of work required to get to the size they need. It's just too difficult. So.
Okay. So that's kind of where it sounds like to me like that's where First Bank is headed. You kind of have this roadmap you're working on building. I know you're adding branches and things like that now. Is that right?
We're up to 10 branches, $750 million in assets, and more growth ahead if things go well. So we knew going in that the world was changing and that the minimum size you needed to run a good community bank was larger than it used to be. So for us, it's just been a continuation of the strategic plan we had in place at the time we started. But realistically, in the past, I think a lot of community banks got started not with the goal of getting to that size, more just knowing the people in their community, in their market. Maybe they wanted to dominate a county, but that was sort of the high end of the range in terms of their goals. And I think you just need to think bigger now if you're going to start up a bank.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating, Patrick. You've really given us a lot to think about. So initially in your career, you had a father that was in banking, so you kind of understood what the skill set might be if you want to be an entrepreneur in banking. So you built up that resume in finance and consulting and business. You got involved in the recapitalization of First Bank, and you're the president and CEO of that, and it's been successful. You're now up to about $750 million in assets. You started off working on getting customer profitability, cleaning up the previous bank issues, dealing with the regulatory environment, as well as moving ahead and differentiating yourself as a community bank, really a solution provider as opposed to a product seller. And so you're moving ahead, and now the future of banking is really that we're not going to have probably quite as many smaller banks, 100 to 200 million. We're really going to see them be a billion and plus, mainly because of the compliance issues and the regulatory issues you have to deal with in order to stay profitable. You're going to just have to be larger, and First Bank is well on its way to doing that. And so we appreciate you very much for coming in today and sharing your information and ideas about what community banking is and why it's important that we have a strong community banking atmosphere. Thanks again. You can reach us here at, this is Master Your Finances. You can reach me directly at cwmi.us. You can send us our ideas on our Facebook page, which is Master Your Finances, facebook.com/Master Your Finances. Any ideas you'd like to see on the show, as well as you can subscribe to the podcast at masteryourfinances.us. Next week, we're going to have on Paul King. Kana and Mark Sorrento from Atrium Health. We're going to discuss planning for assisted living and long-term care. And remember, you too can master your finances and reach your financial peace of mind.
You've been listening to Master Your Finances with Kurt Baker, a certified financial planner professional with certified wealth management and investment, exclusively on 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. Tune in every Sunday morning at 9 to learn everything you need to know about personal and small business financial planning, including investing, estate planning, insurance, employee benefits, 401k and 403b plans, retirement planning, and more. Miss an episode? Go to 107.7thebronx.com to download and listen to previous shows. Master Your Finances is underwritten by Certified Wealth Management and Investment, focusing on personal, financial, and small business planning. For more information about all of Certified Wealth Management and Investment services, online, it's cwmi.us.